Good evening. Thank you for coming. My name is Sherm Teichman. I direct the Institute for Global Leadership. It's a great honor to welcome back an epic alumnus, Matt Bai. Graduated, as best as I can remember, 89 or 90?
90.
Remained a friend. A good friend whose sarcasm is deeply appreciated. More appreciated is his insight, his wit, his acumen. Matt is someone who cut his teeth as being the editor of our briefing book, The Militarization of the Third World. At that point in journalism, I think you laid things out with an X-Acto knife and little liner tape or God knows what those things were, agate, whatever that was. It was remarkable. I think you inaugurated, without anybody misunderstanding it, I think we put in a briefing book futon. It was 24-hour work. But I think I remember you, Matt, as well as a student in one of our courses on journalism and foreign policy and thinking about East Timor when no one was thinking about it. But it's a tremendous pleasure to welcome you back here. Matt's work clearly now is in the Sunday New York Times. He's a senior writer on the political scene. His book, The Argument, is a remarkable work. This is just a wonderful moment to welcome back an old friend. But we've asked him to come here and be insightful about his direct, upfront personal experiences as covering this campaign. It's an incredible, pivotal moment. 8 days, I think. Is it 8 more days? 8 more days. So, come on, Matt. Think with us. And welcome back to Tufts.
Thank you. This is cool. It's just a computer. It's not a real microphone. I got to figure out how to do this at home. Really freak people out. Thank you very much. I'm just chewing up a cough drop. I have a bad cough, so if I start coughing, I apologize in advance if I start coughing. It's nothing horribly contagious. You need not run. I was actually on Charlie Rose Friday night, and they actually had to cut segments of me having coughing fits. Which wasn't helpful, and also made me sound like I was starting every thought mid-sentence. Let me just start by talking for a minute about what it is for me to come back here and talk to all of you. I've been in Boston. I was just telling someone I've been in Boston a bunch lately, which is weird because I can go a long time without being here. I was at the Kennedy Library. I did an event on internet and politics a couple of months ago, and I was at the Kennedy School. I spoke at a dinner on race and politics. Which is something I've been thinking a lot about. But coming here, for me, is always like coming home, in a way, because I did so much growing up here. And I would say to the students here that it's always good and useful to come back to the places where you grew up and where you felt some anxiety and where you dreamed about the future but also had a lot of fear about the future. Because most of you will go out and achieve a lot of what you want to achieve in the world and have a lot of opportunities because you're at a great school and you're all really smart and probably have it a lot more together than I did. And you get to a point where you can get detached enough, you begin to feel like things came pretty easily and like you didn't really have all that much help along the way or you weren't really lucky, you were just really good. And you start to think too much of your own opinion on things. And there's a value, I think, to coming back to the places where you immediately reconnect with those feelings of anxiety and concern about the future because you remember how hard it was and you remember that you did get a lot of help along the way. And I had a lot of help at several junctures in my life and in my career, and none more so than from Sherman and also from Heather. And I'm deeply indebted to everything they've done for me, not just professionally also, but personally and in just being there to build my confidence when I needed it, and also in very practical ways. But I always remember when I get emails from people and phone calls. This is not to invite you all to email me personally, but I do get a fair amount of emails from people asking about careers or advice and things. And you get really, really busy, and you get hundreds of them, and you kind of want to just move on. But when I come back here and to a few other places in my life, I always remember that you always want someone to have done that for you, and it's something you owe to other people. So I'm always glad to come back here and to stay connected to Tufts. We're hearing a lot. I want to talk a little bit about the campaign tonight, where we are. We're a week out. There's not a lot of new light to shed on what the dynamic of the campaign is. You pretty well know that. I want to talk a little bit about where we're going to be a week from now, what we're going to know, because you're probably hearing a lot now in the news and among your own conversation and maybe in your classrooms about 1932. I was just talking to Professor Dappas, one of my economics professor here my freshman year, about what a remarkable time this is. There are a lot of similarities between now and a period that, of course, no one in this room remembers. No one in this room remembers, right? Well, Sherman probably, but no one else remembers that. You know, we have the crashing market, the government essentially nationalizing banks, taking over lenders, talking about restructuring mortgages, deficits rising to unprecedented levels. I read a story that really stuck with me in the Times, I don't know, maybe 10 days ago, about a woman in Ohio who, facing foreclosure, took a gun to her chest and shot herself. And there have been many other stories like this that resonate from those of us who've read about the histories of the Great Depression. And that translates into a political piece as well, a comparison, because people inevitably begin to see this election in a same transformative way as 1932. Franklin Delano Roosevelt swept into office with the first Democratic majority in a very long time and realigned American politics going forward for 75 years and gave us essentially what we think of as the modern American government, and social contract and foreign policy. And there is a sense that there's a real change taking place. I think there are some similarities. My friend John Harris, my friend and colleague, who's the editor of the Politico, gave a speech similar to this one on some campus in the last few weeks, and said he thinks that Obama will get 350 electoral votes and a wide majorities in the House and Senate. I don't know that I would be that expansive about it. I don't like to make predictions because I hate being wrong. I try not to do that on TV. But I will say, you know, 4 years ago I spent election night in Columbus, Ohio. 4 years before that, I was in Washington with Ralph Nader, which is a whole other story. But, you know, 4 years ago, I was in Columbus, and we all sat in this ballroom full of volunteers, and I watched the television, you know, anchors all start to zero in on this one patch of land in the middle of the country that was Ohio in this kind of surreal moment. Oh, thank you very much, especially since I have a bottle and left it in my bag. So thanks. You know, watched as they, late in the night, called Ohio, and there were groans, and there were tears, and there was silence, and there were people who just walked out of the room in despair. And it occurs to me that for those of you who are students here, this is all you know of American elections. You probably, if your political consciousness begins somewhere either just before or around the year 2000, you could be excused for thinking that American campaigns are really, really exciting, and they generally come down to like half a percentage point on election night, and it comes down to a handful of states, and it goes all night, and you don't really know who wins till the next day. That's, in fact, not the case. Traditionally, the norm in presidential politics is that races break at some point before election day. They're pretty much decided before they're decided, and there's generally a decent spread that is very, very difficult to overcome. In the 68 years since Franklin Delano Roosevelt swept into office, only a handful of races, 1948, 1960, 1968, 1976, and then these last two we've had have been really decided by anything that you could call narrow margins. I think this election broke probably the week after the initial stock market collapse. I think people have effectively voted, and I think it's very, very hard to change that pattern. Things can happen. There can be some cataclysmic event. You know, I think if Obama were caught on tape saying, you know, I don't know if you can trust all these white people to vote for a black guy. You know, anything that put him in that showed him to have a sensitivity about race, I think could be very damaging. You know, people have talked about a terrorist attack. I guess that could be very damaging, although, frankly, I'm not sure that would be enough for Republicans at this point. Because I think the legacy of the Bush years is such that American voters might well turn to a terrorist attack and say, just another thing that got messed up on their watch. Or they didn't even keep us safe. Right, so I tend to think that wouldn't necessarily break the way a lot of people think it would. So barring something like that, I think this election is pretty well set. So the question is, if Obama wins, and perhaps if he doesn't, I do think we are at a moment of a truly tectonic shift in American politics, a moment where social and economic and technological changes all collide to form one of those pivotal moments in the life of a nation, like I think 1932 did and like 1960 did. And there are questions that may be answered, at least in my mind, or at least that may be illuminated by what happens Tuesday, not just by who wins, but by what margins and in which states, that I think are important to understanding politics going forward. So I want to run through five questions that I myself am curious to have an answer to on Election Day, and I think we may go some way toward answering. The first is, can the internet matter where it counts? And that is in actually bringing voters to the polls. Now, so far, the internet politics has been absolutely revolutionary, but it's been revolutionary in two main ways that you all know. One is in fundraising. I mean, I have numbers I used to run through to talk about this, but there's really no point in running through them, because the only thing you need to know is that last month, Barack Obama raised $150 million. I'm trying to put that in context. I'm not sure what the best way is. That's as much as John McCain gets to raise under the federal system in the primary and the general election total. Howard Dean, the father of internet fundraising, raised $25 million online in his entire 2004 campaign. Obama is now at somewhere around $600 million, most of it online with an average contribution of something like $85. So this is the new age. It's not just Obama. He's got a great moment. He's created a lot of excitement. But the internet has totally changed fundraising. It's also created an entirely new space for community building and for discussion of politics. You all know a lot about this. It's what my book is about, the blog space that you have. But what the net hasn't done to this point is to turn out votes or replace traditional field programs. Now, Obama showed the potential of change in the technological way during the primaries. One of the most interesting examples to me was the caucus in Idaho, where in a state where there's virtually no Democratic presence, all these people went online to My Barack Obama. How many people here? Do people here have MyBO.com accounts? So I still think that's very unfortunately named, but maybe it's generational. But people in Idaho went out and joined thousands and thousands of volunteers before a single Obama staffer had stepped foot in Idaho to take control of the effort there. They had found space to lease, and they had scheduled an event and gotten a venue. And I think something like 10 or 15,000 people, I may have that number wrong, but thousands and thousands of people came out to see Obama in Idaho. That was all volunteer-driven, and those volunteers were all brought in online. The question is, that's an entry point for volunteerism, but does it actually bring in votes? And we're going to know this a little bit more in some of the battleground states on Tuesday. We'll know it not just by looking at the number of new voters, but particularly at the percentage of voters who turn out. I think if the percentages rise in a lot of these states, you can attribute it to a lot of different things fairly, but I think technology, the driving these people out with the internet, which is really a large part of Obama's turnout model, will have to get some of the credit. And I think it's an interesting thing to watch. The second question I would ask, a little more existentially, is does experience in the traditional sense still matter in national politics? Because any way you look at it, Barack Obama has historically little experience for a presidential candidate or for a president. Now, I know there are people in this room and elsewhere who are always going to argue this point. I've argued this point with people far smarter than myself. And I know they're going to talk about FDR and John Kennedy. They were thought to be inexperienced in their day. You know, but in fact, FDR had been a Navy secretary, he'd been a governor, John Kennedy had served in war, which frankly to me is no small piece of experience. He'd also been in Congress and in the Senate. Obama, by contrast, when he introduced himself to the country at his keynote address in 2004, had never run a statewide, that was his first statewide presidential campaign, he had never won statewide in the state of Illinois. 4 years later, he comes on stage to accept the Democratic nomination for the presidency. That's quite remarkable. Inevitably, of course, inevitably, someone brings this conversation back to Abraham Lincoln. And I get that. Okay, you're going back 148 years. You can find a president who probably had as little experience as Obama, I think a single term in Congress. But it's worth noting that things were exceedingly different in 1860. For one thing, it was a three-party election, which is extremely rare in American politics and would not have been possible. His victory would not have been possible without that. It's also true the candidates didn't actually even campaign for president. In 1960, it was Lincoln himself who changed that tradition 4 years later. But in fact, at that time, you were supposed to sit home and your party went out and did the campaigning. It's not exactly an apples and apples comparison. Why then is it happening now? Why is Obama a viable candidate for president when somebody else with his experience level has not been for such a long time? Some of it has to do with the moment. Some of it has to do with a really singular talent that he has. He is a tremendous political talent. But I think it's very hard to separate out Obama from the larger cultural trend that is basically internet-driven in America. And I don't think 20 years ago Obama's candidacy would have been possible. I don't think even 10 years ago it would have been possible. Because the truth is that the culture has changed, the internet has changed the way culturally we live our lives in all kinds of ways. You don't do banking. You know, when I was here at Tufts, which wasn't that long ago, you balanced a checkbook if you were really responsible, or you did all your banking at a branch. The first thing I did when I came to Tufts on campus was I I had opened an account through some student thing, and I went down to the branch, and I met the teller, and I don't know what you do. I'd never used an ATM. I didn't even know what it was. Right? Now everybody does their banking online, 24 hours a day. You want to do your banking, you know, you pay your bills yourself. You want to invest your money, you used to take it to a broker. You don't go to a broker anymore. Now people go to E-Trade. They trade it themselves. They're their own experts. They figure out their own expertise is what matters. You used to go to a doctor to find out what was wrong with you. You don't do that anymore. Now you go online, you diagnose yourself. I got this rash. I have a horrible disease. You go to the doctor. I have this horrible disease. This is the medicine I need. Please give it to me, right? There has been a general devaluing of expertise in the culture across the board. My wife and I just bought a car. My wife bought a car last week. Car shopping. You used to go to a dealer's lot and you said, what cars do you have? Are they good? Do they, you know, are you sure it hasn't been in an accident? Now you go online, you search for all the cars at all the dealerships, you get their Carfax reports, you find out, you show up at the dealer, you say, here's the car I want, here's what I'm willing to pay for. And I happen to know it's the right price because there's a guy here who's willing to sell it to me for less, right? So we don't really recognize institutional expertise in the way we used to. My friend Gina Cooper, the founder of Netroots Nation, used to be Yearly Coast, likes to say to her about her volunteers, be your own expert. And I think that's the emerging American culture. And I think in a society like this, Obama really reflects that trend because he is, in a sense, he subjugates institutional expertise to this broader idea of judgment, to this idea that you can make yourself expert enough to handle whatever comes at you. By the way, so too, of course, does Sarah Palin reflect this trend. It seems to me she considers any question about her expertise to be an affront to small-town America, and any suggestion that you should actually know something about the issues of the day is, like, say, history of the government or the Supreme Court, is met with derision, and at some rallies it's met with outright hatred. These are considered gotcha questions to Sarah Palin, but in general I don't think people actually vote for the second person on the ticket. They generally vote for the presidential candidate. So I think it's Obama's experience that's at issue, and I think if he wins, it'll go a substantial way toward making this larger culture a part of politics as well, in that the threshold for acceptable experience for a presidential candidate, I think, will have been changed for this entire era going forward. The third question I would ask as you watch the results come in is, can issues trump demographics? You know, in 1964, it's famously said, it's recounted, that when Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, he famously turned to his advisors and said, I've just signed away a generation of voters to the Republican Party. The truth was actually, I think, far more profound than President Johnson understood, because it wasn't just segregation, it wasn't just civil rights. That value split actually spread to every part of the country. As far west as Wyoming and Utah, as far north as the suburbs around Pennsylvania and Ohio, places where segregation itself had never been at issue. Why? Some of this was directly related to economic anxiety and change and transition, because suddenly the country was undergoing this massive underlying change, especially among the middle class. And there's no doubt that conservatives exploited this expertly. They learned very quickly that they could use intolerance to promote their own aims. The Southern strategy wasn't only about the South, after all. It was really about any place where Americans felt that they were backsliding while somebody else was getting a break or somebody else was getting ahead. But, you know, liberals bear a lot of the blame for this historical trend as well, because there was an anti-military, anti-establishment strain that took root in American liberalism in the years after civil rights in Vietnam. And to a lot of Americans, it felt very much like condescension. The sense that rural and working class voters, with their fervent religion and their guns and their small town values and their traditional notions of what makes up a family and what ethnic and racial differences should mean in society, just weren't very smart and just didn't get it. And it continues today, by the way, inside the Democratic Party. This is nothing new. One of the most popular books after the 2004 campaign cycle was Thomas Frank's What's the Matter with Kansas? Right, the idea that what was wrong with all these rural voters who kept voting against their economic self-interest, quote-unquote, was that they just weren't very sophisticated and Republicans were able to exploit their basic lack of intellect. George Lakoff, very famous, brilliant linguist at Berkeley, who wrote a book all about, no, it's not true. It's not that they're not sophisticated. It's actually that their brains have been rewired by very subtle messages being sent out, and their brains no longer, their synapses no longer fire the way they should. That's what's wrong with these voters. And just the other day, you had Representative Murtha, Congressman Murtha in Pennsylvania, caught on video talking about voters in his own area, his own district, I believe, as being redneck, which highlighted to me a very, what I think is a very salient fact, which is If I used a racial or ethnic slur, I would, in this speech or in this audience or any other, I would rightfully be condemned and I'd be drummed out of here and I wouldn't be invited back to speak. But you can use the word redneck at just about any university or dinner party in liberal America and nobody cares. It's perfectly acceptable and it ought not to be. And this is the reason that Democrats have continued to lose these votes. In the 44 years, am I right, since 44 years since Lyndon Johnson won his full term as president, only one Democratic nominee has won a majority of the vote in America, an actual outright majority. That was Jimmy Carter in 1976, in the era after Watergate, a very era very much like this one, where everything was running in his favor, and he won 50.1% of the vote, landslide. And a lot of this, of course, most of this is because of the break between Democrats and white men, and particularly lower-income white men and lower-educated white men. Al Gore and John Kerry just tried to change the subject. They said, issues matter more. Forget about all this world stuff, all this gun stuff. We're going to do better for you on the issues. John Kerry lost white men in America by 25 points. It's a pretty big margin. Barack Obama would seem like a very unlikely guy to turn around this trend. First of all, he's not white. He's not a white guy, which you'd think would put him at somewhat of a disadvantage when trying to woo white guys. But in fact, he has spent more time, money, and effort than any Democratic presidential candidate, at least since 1992, and I would argue since the 1960s, trying to turn this around, trying to win in places where Democrats never win. He has been to Appalachian Virginia, Montana, North Dakota, North Carolina, Nevada, Georgia. Not just a few times, he's been there multiple times. And I saw him, and I was with him when he did an appearance in Southwest Virginia recently, in Appalachian Virginia, Russell County, where they hadn't seen any presidential candidate come into town since Jimmy Carter, and they hadn't seen a Democratic nominee in memory. Like no one living memory could ever remember a Democratic nominee actually coming to town. He's opened offices in Southwestern Virginia where people have never seen a presidential office for any party, period. And not just one, dozens of them. And I think he has a real chance to win some of these states. Now, the interesting thing is why. I mean, he has a real chance to win them, largely because of what's happened in the economy. And Obama himself told me a few weeks ago when I interviewed him on his plane, and he gets this. He said, you know, I've not bridged the cultural divide. In fact, he says, I'm winning in a lot of these places. I'm doing well because of what's happened in the economy. He said, but what I've come to understand is that you can't actually do this in a campaign. You can only do it as president. I think instead of people getting to know you and then they vote for you, you have to win. And then they get to know you, which I thought was a pretty fascinating commentary. But I think he's committed to doing that. If he does win a bunch of these states or a bunch of these districts, I think what it means is he's going to get an opportunity to redraw the political map in a very transformational way. And that's something really to watch, is how many of these red states actually go into the Democratic column at the end of the day. The fourth question I would pose is race still the defining obstacle that we think it is? Now, I've had a running argument with people about this all year. I've been vastly outnumbered until the last couple of days. I see Frank Rich has come around. And Michael Pollan did a piece on the front page of the Times today, sort of getting at some of the things I've been talking about. But, you know, a lot of the fears about race are driven by polling. See, for years, pollsters told us that you actually couldn't poll race. It was hopeless. You couldn't do it. Voters won't tell you the truth. Then it turned out we got a black candidate, and there's a whole lot of money to be made in polling race. And so all of a sudden, you can poll race. And the way they do it, you know, I want to say, and so these polls, I mean, for instance, you see, there was the most influential of these was probably an AP Yahoo poll from, it was a couple months ago, which basically they did an analysis, Stanford University was involved in it, and they decided that Obama would be 6 points higher in the polls were it not for race. And there's basically been a general consensus among Democrats for most of this campaign that were it not for race, Obama would be doing considerably better. This despite the fact, by the way, that he's running about the same as he's running better, actually, than Kerry or Gore were at this point. If you froze the polling today, he's going to do better among white men than either of them would have done. And as someone pointed out to me, as a rural expert pointed out to me, they were white last time he checked. But nonetheless, this has been a defining narrative. Let me just say three things about this. First of all, I think the polling isn't very good, and here's why. Because the way they poll this, I think it's really quite bogus. The way they poll this is by proxy. Because they know they can't get you, they can't ask you, are you a racist? People tend to say no. So they do this proxy. Have you ever watched like old TV shows? You know, the person always goes to the therapist and they say, my friend is having a problem. You know, it's not me, it's my friend. Really? Well, tell your friend he should try a new kind of soap, right, or whatever. So they do this kind of proxy thing where they ask you about your friends and your neighbors, and they assume that you're really not talking about your friends and your neighbors. You're really talking about yourself. So the New York Times did a poll several months ago, and they found 19% of the white respondents said their friends and neighbors were not, in their estimation, going to vote for a black candidate because of race. That's a pretty striking number. That's 20% of your voters who are saying that race would be a big enough issue not to vote for Barack Obama. And here's the thing that, if you look carefully at the data, and I did, 16% of the black respondents said they didn't think their friends and neighbors were going to vote for a black man. Now, I doubt very much that that's a proxy for racism among black voters. I suspect strongly that what that is a reflection of a kind of fear and cynicism and nervousness about the electorate, about the way your neighbors actually feel. People are actually answering the question, and they have a deep fear for you about the way that their friends and neighbors and relatives who they've heard express racial sentiments over the years will receive a black candidate. But that is not the same as a proxy, and it's not a good polling sample. The second is, I think we asked the wrong question. Because what polls like this invariably ask is there racial bias? Can we document racial bias? And when people look at Obama, do they look at him under the rubric of that racial bias? Well, I don't know who's paying a pollster to figure that out, but I can save them the money right now. I don't need a poll to tell you there's racism in America. I don't need a poll to tell you that when people look at Barack Obama, they see a black man, and they therefore see him differently. This should not surprise anyone. Now walk out your door. This is pretty clear. The question isn't, is race a factor? The question is race a determinative factor in the way people vote? In 1928, when Al Smith ran for president, Catholicism was a determinative factor. He could not get past it. Too many Protestants were not going to pull the lever for a Democratic, and there weren't enough Catholics voting to make up the difference. And he won some, I think, I'm now drawing from memory, I think he won his own state of New York and about four states in the Deep South. He had a Deep Southern running mate, and those were solid, Democratic Dixie post-Reconstruction states. But he basically got blown out. Like, nobody voted for Al Smith. In 1960, when John Kennedy ran for president, Catholicism was still an issue, right? But it wasn't the only issue. He felt it sufficiently problematic to give a major speech on it, just as Barack Obama did on race during the primaries. But at the end of the day, there were some sizable number of Protestants or Jews or whatever else who held an anti-Catholic bias, voted for him despite their fears about the Pope controlling government. And it was enough to make him president. It was not a determinative, it was not a disqualifying factor for voters the way that it had been 32 years earlier. The final thing I would say is, yes, there are undoubtedly some segment of race voters, people who will not vote for Barack Obama because he's black. I think anecdotally, if you went around the room, if you're from some parts of the country, you'll know somebody for whom this is the case. Anecdotally, you probably also know somebody who has a racial hang-up is going to vote for him anyway, which are the stories that are now starting to emerge in the media coverage and on the blogs. I have relatives who fall into that category. But there are some segment of race voters. Race is not new to Democratic-Republican campaigns. I was at a dinner with Governor Dukakis a couple of weeks ago, and this came up, and I reminded him, race is not new. Were you not the one who got the Willie Horton ad? Was that not about race? And he was a white candidate. And he said, yes, but what they're doing now is worse than Willie Horton. And I said, Governor, all due respect, I don't think so, actually. I think Willie Horton was quite terrible. And all the students are looking at me blankly. Willie who? Well, look it up on Wikipedia. I do. Race is a factor. But I think, first of all, most of the people who vote based on race are going to vote Republican anyway. They've probably been identified with the Republican Party for a long period of time. Second, there's a balance here. John Kerry won 60% of the got a 60% turnout among African Americans in 2004. He won about 88%, according to the exit polling, of African Americans. Obama's almost certainly going to get 3 to 5 points even higher turnout than that, and he's almost certainly going to get 92, 94% of that yield. I'd be very surprised if it was under 92%. That's a lot of votes. That means in a lot of states, race could actually bring him more votes than it drives away. So I think they're counting like John Kennedy got a lot of help from new Catholic immigrants. I think race could actually cut Obama's way in a lot of these states. So my final question I would ask you is, are the 60s finally over? When Gary Hart ran for president in 1984, he gave America a preview of its immediate future. Hart was not a baby boomer, by the way. He was technically, if you take out the years, he was a post-war candidate. But in any way that counted, he was culturally with the baby boomers. He'd been there for the 60s. He'd managed McGovern's campaign in 72. He was very attractive to younger voters. He had a new way. He was one of the Atari Democrats. He had a new way of looking at politics. And he was the greatest mind, arguably, of his generation. I believe he was probably the greatest political mind of his generation from a politician. And Hart kicked open the door. He lost in 84, very narrowly to Walter Mondale. But he kicked open a door that had been closed to the baby boomer generation. And there was no stopping it. It was coming through at that point. And essentially, we would get one more pre-boomer president after that. But from 1992 until the present, American politics has been dominated by boomers and the 60s generation. And in a way, Hart previewed everything that was to come later. The wasted potential and promise, the self-absorption, the politics of personality over vision, the celebritization, the trivialization of American politics, the obsession with personal scandals. Basically, this is the first generation that has met transformational challenges in American government and completely failed to meet them. They have been, as a generation of leadership, an abysmal failure. And as Obama himself has said, the campus wars of the 1960s just continue to play on an endless loop over and over again to no purposeful end, while fundamental challenges in the country, economic, social, technological changes, proliferate all around us and go unmet. So, by the way, I talk about this a lot. I had somebody who wrote in, it was a Daily Coast reader, wrote in and said, "Why do you always want to throw my generation under a bus?" I said, "No, ma'am, you misunderstand me. I don't want to throw you under a bus at all. I actually want you to have the nice, healthy, happy retirement you've earned. I just don't want you to run the country anymore." Now, Obama is similar to Hart in my sense, in my viewing, because although he's not technically a boomer, whether he is technically a boomer, he's of that generation. He's really culturally not. He comes at the tail end. He's much more cultural. I've just turned 40. He's much more culturally aligned with my generation. And actually, I think we've done a very poor job of documenting the effect of this in the campaign. We've talked a lot about race. I think generation has been at least as important in race in trying to gauge where Obama connects to older white voters. I was on a radio show recently with a black commentator, and she said, "You see racism in the campaign." She said, "You know, when Obama fist bumped his wife, it became a really big deal, and a lot of older voters didn't like it. But, you know, I do that with my family. I do that with my husband. That's just black culture." And I said, "Well, actually, no. I fist bump my 3-year-old son every day. That's actually a generational cultural change. I don't think that's racial at all." And, I think it's very hard to extricate race from generation, because that generational change always makes older voters uncomfortable. When somebody talks differently than you and has different frames of references culturally than you and looks like your kids, I think it's very, very hard to get around that. And so I think that's been a real issue here. But if Obama wins, I do believe it will signal the end of the 60s generation in politics, and not a moment too soon. And I think that's something to look forward to. Now, these are the things I think we'll learn more about on Election Day. I think the biggest things, the biggest questions in the country are going to remain unanswered no matter what. We face, as I said, structural transformational challenges. And that was true even before this reckoning on Wall Street. And your generation, those of you who are students here, you don't need me to say, you know what you're going to inherit as a generation of leadership, because you've seen it on the news and you've seen it in the campaign. It's a dissolving, outdated social contract, soaring entitlement spending that's eating up about half the budget, a world where nuclear weapons are almost certain to fall into the hands of terrorists in the next decade, and of course climate change, which is, if not an existential threat, a very serious threat to quality of life and our economic opportunities as well. Excuse me, I'll note that's the first time I've coughed. Those menthol things are good. And neither party, I don't think, has yet put forth a very compelling argument for this new era, the kind of argument that I think will enable one or the other, and certainly Democrats would seem better poised at this point, to realign American politics for a long time to come. But I'll tell you what I do think. I'll tell you what we ought to know about this. And I'll come back full circle to where I began as I close, which is, I think the one thing we ought to keep in mind that's important and that I think is getting lost is that you can't simply, tempted as we may be to draw historical comparisons, that you can't simply look back to 1932 to find the answers. And looking at that moment as a comparison to this one won't get you where you need to go. Because the history of American leadership, the greatness of American leadership, has been each generation not just trotting out old solutions to meet new problems, but recasting government, recalibrating, looking at a flexible governing system and adapting it to the peculiar challenges of the moment, and doing so with courage and with creativity and with conviction. We can't just say, well, this is 1932 all over again, and Obama, or if it's McCain, they just need to come in and do exactly what FDR did. Because that was a different moment from this one. And I think that leads us to the wrong place. Now, I'm going to close with words from Andy Stern, who's the president of the Service Employees Union, and I think one of the smartest people in politics today. Andy is fond of saying to audiences, you know, we're as far now from the Great Depression as the Great Depression was from the Civil War. And he says, I don't think Franklin Roosevelt looked to Abraham Lincoln to figure out what to do about the depression and the crash of the markets. And I don't think we can look back to Franklin Roosevelt to figure out what we ought to do now. And I think whoever becomes president next week, I think that's pretty good advice to take. I'd be glad to answer your questions. I'm thrilled you all came out tonight. Thank you very much. All right, who's got questions? There's one here. Now, is there any rules to this?
Yeah, just ask them to identify themselves.
Well, I know that. Just in case they're imposters. Yeah, no, tell me who you are. Tell me where you're from, too. I'd like to know that. Go ahead.
I'm Shayna Hurley, and I'm from Weston, Connecticut, which is right near Trumbull, Connecticut, which is where you're from.
I am from there. Thank you.
So
you're not a stalker, are you?
Yeah. No, okay. There's a really famous narrative about in Howard Dean's race, all of these volunteers in orange hats went to Iowa for the primary and got there, and there was nothing they could do. So I was wondering if you could comment, and I know Tough Stuff is called Phone Bank today, which we use my Barack Obama to get kids on the phones. So I was wondering, you know, I know it's early, you said it's a question, it's curious, but what are your preliminary thoughts on the internet and voter turnout?
There was something those orange-hatted kids could do already. They could screw up Howard Dean's primary. That was a disaster. I remember seeing all those orange hats and going, oh, this isn't good. And this is one of the real challenges of the internet age, actually. I don't mean to make fun of Dean. I mean, what do? You can get people to volunteer, but what do you do with them? How do you use their energy, and how do you use it in a way that isn't counterproductive? I'm going to be honest with you. This is an unanswered question for me, and it's one I've thought about a lot, because Obama's opened a ton of state offices. Now, Virginia's the state I know best because I spent some time there for my last cover. He's got about 47 or 48 state offices in Virginia. Now, that's pretty cool. I mean, they're in a lot of communities, and they're drawing in a lot of volunteers. And I think they're in-state volunteers. In other words, I don't think they're having to shuttle a lot of people off. You know, they're probably New Yorkers going to Pennsylvania. But I think, you know, for the most part, those are people showing up. But, you know, as a couple of Virginia politicians mentioned to me with some note of concern, Democratic politicians, they tend to be college kids, younger kids, they tend to be a certain demographic, right? They tend to seem very, very liberal. And they're going out into these communities, some of them quite rural or ex-urban communities, knocking on doors. And, you know, that's different from your neighbor knocking on doors. Now, I know the Obama campaign is trying very, very hard to make this about having your neighbors go out. They have precinct teams that go out. I think they're very well organized. They've really modeled their effort very much on George W. Bush's 2004 effort. In fact, you know, when I wrote about this in 2004, the Democrats all said to me, you can't do this with a volunteer model. You've been taken in. It's a paid model. You got to pay people. You can't do this with volunteers. Now, 4 years later, Obama's all about volunteers, right? That's all. They believe that's the only way to do it, and they've done it, I think, brilliantly. But this question you're asking about, are they the right volunteers in these communities, in Indiana and Virginia and Georgia and North Dakota, are the people knocking on your door or standing outside in the street corner, do they feel like people you know and trust? Are they in-staters? And if they're in-staters, are they a demographic that feels like, you know, that feels like you get them, or do they feel like the same old Children's Crusade liberals that you may have disdained in earlier campaigns? I don't know the answer to that. I think it's a very, very good question. And it could play out poorly for them on election night in some of these states. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Mike.
What part?
Northern Jersey, Burnton County.
That makes you a Yankee fan.
Yeah.
Good, nice. All right.
I have two things. One is a question, one is a comment.
Excuse me.
My question is, assume McCain loses and the Democrats take 59 or 60 seats in the Senate.
Wow, that's a lot, but okay.
Right, well, you know.
Could happen.
Political program down there, and one of the things I had to do was write a big research paper. Actually,
Thank you. I hope you recommended it to friends and did not lend it out. It's in paperback now, by the way, with a new afterword by the author. Nice cover. They changed the subtitle to get that nice New York Times notable book thing on there. All right, enough about that. That's an excellent question. I am dealing with this question right now, actually. I'm thinking this is what my first cover is going to be about after the election. And I don't really want to tell you what I'm thinking specifically about that because I'm too early in the process and I don't really want to get it out there. But I where I want to focus my story. But I think you are going to see to some extent a huge vacuum and a revenge of the moderates probably in some. There are a lot of people who have felt drummed out of the Republican Party who were kind of walking on eggshells through the Bush era. I mean, I think you've already started to see this in the last 2 weeks. Look at the people who have lined up to endorse Obama every day. Colin Powell, but also people lesser known, the former governor of Minnesota, Arne Carlson, a couple of congressmen, a couple of local, I mean, just the kind of people who 2-3 years ago, who've been basically disdainful of this entire era of Republican politics, but 2 or 3 years ago would not have dared come out publicly because it would have foreclosed their options inside the party. And they're now understanding that the party's collapsing and they can stand up. You know, Christy Whitman wrote a very tepid book about what was wrong with the party. McCain, you know, would have chosen a pro-choice running mate if he could have. There's a whole, and you know, that basically eliminated his three top choices. I mean, there's a whole segment of Republicans out there who have felt marginalized. And I do think there's going to be a strong back. There's going to be an I told you so there. And an effort to, if not wield new influence in the party, then at least try. And particularly, you know, the governors are where this usually takes flight, right? There are enough good Republican governors out there, and I think that's where you're going to start to see a new assertive power. I think McCain is really through if he loses. I don't think, you know, it took John Kerry, in my estimation, about 2 years after the 2004 election to really get his head around the idea that it had nothing to do with, that the email lists and the support and the rallies had just nothing to do with him. That he basically borrowed the party for a couple months, but he was not its leader. Right. I mean, I think he really came out, like all presidential candidates, he heard the screams every day for months, and he came out thinking that he owned the party. And in fact, there was just no personal loyalty to him in the Democratic field, in the ranks. I think the same is probably true with McCain. He never had the base. They've never been comfortable with him. He's not made moderates and independents very happy with the campaign he's run. He's 72 years old. He won't run for Senate again. I think his influence just wanes by about 3 a.m. Wednesday morning. And that's that. And so there is going to be this vacuum, and I think it's not just a tactical vacuum in Republican politics, it's an intellectual vacuum, which is something they're not used to. I've heard a really surprising number of Republicans on the Hill, I wouldn't want to exaggerate it, but more than a couple in the last couple of months grousing about their think tanks. You know, the Heritage never does anything useful for us, Cato never does. I mean, these are the think tanks that built the intellectual infrastructure of the modern conservative movement. And, you know, there's a sense that they've gotten lazy and insular and they're playing to politics. And so I think there's a real intellectual space there. And that's what I'm trying to look at for after the election. But you'll have to wait till, like, January or February for that.
Thanks.
Sure. Yes?
Hi, I'm Jeremy from Red SN, Washington, D.C.
Bethesda,
Maryland. Thanks for coming.
Bethesda, terrific.
Yeah, awesome. Great job.
I'll be there tomorrow. Well, I live right next door. But tomorrow the Bethesda Barnes & Noble, you know, downtown, is having a pajama party for my kid's school. When I land tomorrow, I'm bringing him in his pajamas to the bookstore. I am not wearing my pajamas, despite my wife's best efforts. Anyway.
My question is, as you mentioned, this kind of chart of elitism has developed a lot during this campaign. It's been seen as kind of a distinction between like the big city liberals who are doing whatever it is they do and then the rest of the true Americans. But it seems to me that there's a type of chauvinism as well, this emphasis on like small town values. Do you think people will ever recognize that, or is this always going to be seen as kind of essentially
Well, I think it's interesting. You have seen this, right, in the last couple of weeks, maybe emboldened by poll numbers. You've heard a lot of Democrats kind of coming out and saying, a lot of columnists and others kind of saying, hey, wait a minute, who decided you were the real America, right? You know, there's all these people living in urban America. But, so there has been, I think, a kind of reality check on that. I don't think Palin's rhetoric has really gone over. It's gone over for a certain segment of people who come to her rallies. But I think most Americans have kind of looked at that, and they've just gone a little too far. I mean, I thought it was interesting, this, Representative Bachman in Minnesota. I mean, what interested me about that controversy, for those of you who don't know, she said liberals hate America or the real America or something like that. And she's been, she's been, suddenly her race has tightened and she's in real trouble. What I found fascinating about that was that I really think, 2 years ago even, in a congressional race, I don't think people would have blinked at that. I think because of the economics and because of the just complete weariness with the Bush years, it's just gone over the top now. I think people are just sick of that rhetoric and see it as a distraction. And she just walked into a particularly bad moment. I mean, conservative candidates have been saying that liberals hate America forever. And I thought it was so interesting that her comments caused such a backlash. Because I think this is just a moment where people have just about had enough of that kind of divisiveness, which I think a long-awaited moment, right? But I will say this. There's a difference between having power and not having power, between having economic sustainability and not having economic sustainability. So in my own mind, I do not equate the chauvinism of, and I may be wrong, and boy, people have attacked me no end for this, so I'm not, this is just my personal perspective. I do not equate the elitism of urban liberals with the sort of small-minded parochialism of the quote-unquote real America, rural America. I mean, I think when you are the economically strong and educated, and when you have power in the society, you have a responsibility not to condescend, not to practice that kind of bigotry toward quote-unquote redneck Americans that has been practiced by a lot of Democrats. And I'm personally less troubled by small town, politicians who caricature urban liberals, because the people they caricature have all the power and all the education and all the means. And to me, those two things are just not the same. That's why people ask me all the time, why do you get so angry? Why do you get so, I hear this all the time, why do you get so exercised over urban liberals sort of typecasting and looking down on rural Americans when, rural Americans are constantly trying to impose their religious values and their sort of very narrow view of the world on all the people who live in blue states. And by the way, there are more of us than there are of them. And I said, because you have the ability to impose your values and they really don't. And that's kind of how I see it. Yep. Yes?
Hi. My name is Sarah. I'm from Simsbury, Connecticut. And thank you for letting
Simsbury.
Me know this.
Yeah, what's that all about?
Yeah, I'm a scholar. It's a scholar here. So my scholars project is working for campusvoices.org with Harvard IOP. So
oh, yeah. I know them. I know them, yeah.
Yeah. So my question is about journalism and political journalism. There's so much talk about, we're in the age of blogs and snap sayings and, snapshots of really just moments rather than investigative journalism. And I'm just wondering, I just want to hear your comments on how you feel political journalism has evolved because it's so much about image and sound bites now. Where do you feel it's going?
Well, first of all, I mean, there is investigative journalism. There is good quality journalism, and journalism like I do, long feature journalism. So I think when we talk about the media, we have to be very careful to delineate what we mean. The media is much vaster. When you talked about the media 15 years ago, you were talking about three networks, maybe four at that time, a handful of national papers, and a bunch of big regional papers, like the Boston Globe when I started out. Now when you talk about the media, you're talking about cable news, network news, tabloids, national papers, local papers, news services, blogs, ideological outlets, right? So, I mean, there's just such a vast difference between what all of us do. And I think it's very, very hard to generalize about what's happened to journalism in any kind of way writ large, right? So I think there's a lot of quality work being done. I think there's a lot of really crappy work being done. And I think what's required, it requires something of consumers and it requires something of us. So it requires a lot from you because you have to be an educated consumer of news. And you simply have to puzzle through all the different sources. You have to delineate between them. And you have to find the ones you can trust. And you have to consult multiple sources because there's just too much information flying around. And, it requires you to be an active participant in that process, not to just simply be a sedate receiver of information. And so you know, I think that's a, you know, one thing I talk a lot about is media literacy. The idea that if we're going to teach kids, you know, the history of the Revolutionary War seven times between ages, you know, 6 and 15, we could certainly take, you know, or how to diagram a sentence, which, by the way, I can't do. You know, I think we could take 3 months to teach them how to understand what's going on in the media. And by the way, politicians need to differentiate too. Nothing makes me angrier than campaigns and say, you know, well, you know what you and the media always do. You know, the Washington Times said this, or Fox News said that, or, you know, whatever, you know, whatever it is. USA Today said this or that. You know, I said, what kind of sophistication is that? You guys get paid to deal with the media, and this is how you're talking? Like, you think what I do is the same as what the guy on Fox News does? Like, it's incumbent upon everybody to start being more sophisticated. At the same time, I think it's incumbent upon us to get control of this thing. Because there's this gene in American journalism that's about being first. It's a good thing. It's not a bad thing to want to be first, right? We're very competitive. I learned this way. I started covering crime at the Boston Globe, and the whole thing was, you know, did you get to the mother of the victim first? You know, and even then I was like, well, does it really matter? Like, is anybody buying the papers? They want to, you know, because they want the mother's quote. Like, what are we doing here? But it was that's just the DNA of American journalism is about being first. The problem is the cycle used to be, like, daily at best, and then the cycle was like twice a day, and it was like news services, and now the site, you know, then you had cable news, and it was a 24-hour cycle. Now it's like a 10-minute cycle, right? Every reporter is expected to blog. Everybody's supposed to have, you know, everybody's supposed to be updating constantly. And we lose all control of perspective, right? It's like we're so busy trying to have the shred of information that somebody else doesn't have that we're not able to make sense of it for people. And so I think it's incumbent about us, and I mean mainly large newspapers who've really controlled the media landscape for a long time, in terms of the agenda that gets discussed on TV and elsewhere, to get control of this thing and say, you know what, we want to be first to a point, but we're not going to have a 15-minute news cycle. We're not going to have our reporters worried about little minutia all day long and miss the point, right? We are just not going to compete with that. You want to break news every 15 minutes? Be our guest. Well, this is our cycle and we're sticking to it, right? I think we're still trying to get our heads around that. Somewhere we have to draw the line and say this is about being right, this is about being whole, and this is not about being first all the time. And not about being different all the time, and that I think is you know, something we have to, you know, really begin to wrestle with. Yes. What's your name?
Matan.
Matan.
Yes.
Gotcha.
Follow-up question on that: 10 years from now, you're writing a book for 2008 election.
God, I hope not.
Well, yeah. What sources?
Yeah, and there have been good news sources. I mean, Politico, you know, has broken several of the great best stories of this campaign cycle. They're doing terrific work on the sort of small, you know, on the day-to-day. And some of the, I mean, Huffington Post has had a couple of big scoops in this election. I know the guy running their campaign project, Mark Cooper, he's a terrific journalist. But I'm a little bit of a dinosaur this way. So probably 10 years from now, I'll be the wrong person to ask because I will be significantly past the point of my greatest understanding of the political scene. Is if you stick around too long, you're always kind of looking backward. But I think I would still go to the traditional sources on the theory that it doesn't matter who got it first. Something may have emerged on the blogs, but if it mattered, it still found its way into the New York Times or the Washington Post, you know, or any, you know, small number of outlets. And I do think that if you really wanted to understand what was happening in the whole campaign and you could choose only one medium where you had to narrow your sources, you'd still go to the large national newspapers. I think they're still doing the best, most comprehensive work. And they're not always first. And they're not always quick to react. But they are sort of fair and exhaustive and accurate. And I think the coverage of this campaign has been quite good by, you know, reputable national media. I actually think it's, I mean, everybody loves to bash media. They didn't do this. They didn't do that. I love that because the things they didn't do are always something that somehow you heard of. Why aren't you writing the story about, you know, Tom DeLay's, you know, Tom DeLay's financial connections? And like, well, how did you hear about them? Exactly. But did you go through his garbage in Sugar Land? No, you read about it in a newspaper. What people really mean when they say that is, why aren't you writing that story every day? Well, there's only so much you can do, right? You write a story, either it takes or it doesn't. But I do think if you went back and looked at just, you know, what the New York Times has done in this campaign, or a handful of other papers, the Journal, the Post, LA Times, I think the coverage has actually been quite good and quite substantive. There's been an awful lot of fact-checking, almost an obsession with fact-checking, and I think that's been useful. Yes? Then I'll come over here.
My name's Duncan. I'm from Martha's
Vineyard. That must be nice. Have we met before? Did you ask a question somewhere else?
I did, yeah.
Because I was going to say, there's no way I met two people from Martha's Vineyard in a relatively short time. Okay. Aren't there like 12 people at the high school or something at Martha's Vineyard?
No.
800, okay. That's pretty good. All right.
Assuming Obama wins, I was wondering what you think he is or should be looking for in his cabinet.
That's an interesting question. First of all, no one would ask me that. I'm the least qualified person in the world to assemble a cabinet. I know my limitations, and I've never governed. So I wouldn't presume to tell Barack Obama what he should do. But I think he's going to do something smart. I think he's going to do two things that are smart and that are probably going to be unpopular with some segment of his supporters. I could be wrong about this, so we'll see. In a few, you know, a couple months, you can look and say, that guy was an idiot. You can say it was. Well, but I think, the first thing is, I think he's smart enough, and this is where senators, I was just saying at dinner before this, this is where senators, actually, although we think of governors as being so much better qualified to be president generally, this is where senators have an advantage, I think, and actually make better presidents in some way. They understand the inside game. Obama's too smart, I think, and has been around Washington just long enough, at any rate, not to do what Bill Clinton did and bring his boyhood friend to run the White House, or to do what Jimmy Carter did and bring his, you know, Georgia chief of staff to run the White House. Like, I don't think it's going to be even his Senate chief of staff to run the White House. I mean, it could be, but it's a very good chief of staff from everything I know. But I think Obama's going to get himself is going to assemble a pretty insider core at the White House. He understands how you have to understand how government works in order to run it and bend it to your will. And you can't, you know, you can be an outsider, but you still have to be able to pull the levers effectively. So I think his cabinet and his White House team, also, you know, Bill Clinton's last hire practically was his chief of staff. Unfathomable to me. If you're going to build a company, what do you begin with? Like, you hire all the data entry clerks and then a CEO? It doesn't make any sense, right? Like, I mean, I think Obama will get to his chief of staff within several days. The rumored candidate is Tom Daschle. I have no inside knowledge, but I have talked to people who do, and they've not warned me off that at all. So I think he's left his people with the impression that it's Tom Daschle. Whether or not it is, I don't know. And I don't know if that's a great idea, frankly. I don't know that senators make very good chiefs of staff, but I guess we'll find out. So that's one thing, you know, is how you build your leadership team. The second thing is, I think he's going to – I would expect him to give some high-profile cabinet posts and probably more than one to Republicans. I don't think he's going to do the – I could be dead wrong. I have no inside knowledge on this. But I would be very surprised if he did the usual, like, HUD secretary or, you know, transportation. What's the other cabinet department no one can name? Here's a Republican who's really just a Democrat but looks like a Republican, and throw him in the office. I've got a bipartisan – poor Norman Mineta, right? Norman Mineta has been everybody's bipartisan guy for, like – but he's like a holdover from Clinton to Bush. And then Bush kept shifting him around. He's done like a couple of cabinet departments. Send Norman Mineta over there. The least objectionable Democrat I know in every Arkansas. I have a bipartisan cabinet. I don't think Obama's going to do that. I think he's serious. He understands that he has asked for a mandate on this issue, and he has made it very clear that he intends to change the political culture, and that has to begin with the cabinet. And it might really anger some Democrats if he ends up giving something. I mean, how many high-profile cabinet positions are there to give away? Defense at a time of war in Iraq? The Justice Department at a time when civil liberties are so under attack, right? I mean, state? I mean, there are very few high-profile positions you can actually give to a Republican without infuriating your base. But I would not be at all surprised to see him do it, and I think it would be the right move to make. And look, there are enough qualified, like-minded Republicans out there. That's probably why half of them are out there endorsing him, because they can see this coming. And, you know, there are enough you know, quality Republican public servants for him to be able to do that without sacrificing his core vision. And I think it would send the signal that he means what he says and his rhetoric. I also think it would be easier to get things done on Capitol Hill. Because one of the things that's going to happen when he builds these big majorities is a lot of the people who are going to sweep in, particularly in the House and also in the Senate, are going to be from districts and states that are traditionally more conservative. And they're going to know that they got in on a tidal wave. And they're going to want to hold on to the tree, right? They're not going to want to do anything that puts them makes them vulnerable 2 years or 6 years later. And so you cannot, I don't care how good your margins are, you can't really expect to pass an agenda with only Democrats. That's what Bill Clinton had to do. Republicans basically said, we're not going to work with you on the budget. They saw the position he was in. He passed his budget with Gore as the tiebreaker, but he wasn't able to pass health care or anything else because you simply can't get enough votes. There's no party discipline, particularly the Democratic Party, is not that strict. So you've got to get somebody. Your life is a whole lot easier if there's some segment of people who are going to cross the aisle for you. And I think, you know, a couple of high-profile Republican cabinet positions would go a world toward, you know, backing up his rhetoric and opening the minds of some moderate Republicans who might be inclined to support his agenda. Yes, ma'am.
I'm a Yankee fan.
Oh, you're a Yankee fan too, then.
Sorry.
I don't think we can trust her.
Yeah.
She's one of these people that comes to touch starts wearing Red Sox shirts and she's lost forever.
I'm from
Yeah.
So I was wondering, with all this like new media, like blogs and like all these different internet websites, do you think that the people that aren't already like educated, like maybe liberal or just educated people, aren't reading them? Like, are people like independents reading them, or do you think about that? Like, is this actually affecting someone other than the people who already are obsessed with it?
God, I don't know who's reading them. You know, and
the
questions with all these blogs and websites and other things, like who's reading them? Do I think independents are reading them? Are they educated people reading them? Like, who's getting their information from these sources? Is it going to change? I mean, I don't know. I've had a very hard time adapting to the new media landscape. I'm resistant to blogging. I did a so-called blog on the Times site for a couple months in the winter, but it was really like a daily column the way I wrote it, and it was killing me, and it wasn't making the op-ed page very happy either, so I had to stop. I've been really resistant to the idea of blogging. I hate cable TV. I'm really kind of old-fashioned in a way that's probably not that helpful for me. Here's my fear about this climate. It goes to your question. I say this often. I'm not pretending I just thought of it. I say it all the time, but I'll say it here again. My fear is that we're leaving the age of persuasion and entering this age of confirmation. That it used to be people took a story and they looked at it against other stories and they made a judgment whether or not they agreed with your essential point or not. They made a judgment about whether you were right on some or wrong on some, and they used that information to form their judgments. They were persuaded or not persuaded. Now it's like people read the first 200 words of an 8,000-word story, and if you don't immediately validate their worldview, confirm for them what they believe, they toss it aside. Why bother reading this garbage? What do you know? It's the devaluing of expertise I was talking about before. And anyway, there's like 1,000 websites out there that are going to tell me exactly what I believe the world to be as soon as I go onto them. I can go to Daily Coast and everybody will tell me I'm right about everything. So why in the world do I want to read you trying to challenge what I believe? And, that's a problem, and it's a bigger problem for journalists, because we have some segment of commentators and columnists in my business who've heard the applause, right, the roar of the crowd, and it's very seductive. And good journalists, good columnists, good commentators on TV have become robots. They're telling the same story over and over and over to the same audience because it makes them very loved, and it's also quite profitable if you happen to be writing a book on the same topic, right, or something like that. So I've never really gone in for that. I think that's an abdication of our basic responsibility. Our responsibility is to challenge our own preconceptions when we go out to report news. That's what you do as a good journalist. And I think it's to challenge your preconceptions and to try and make you see the world in more complex ways. Our job is to add layers of complexity, which I'm very fortunate to be able to do in one of the few great remaining outstanding print venues. Unfortunately, we seem to be taking complexity away. We seem to be draining it out. And I think that's the influence of this blog and website culture on the so-called mainstream media. That's the part we can control, and to me, that's the problem. I don't know who's getting all their information from these places, but we ought to be challenging them, whoever they are. And we're not. Too often, we're just not. Yes?
My name is Ben from outside Philadelphia. Quick question. Just wanted to know, to what extent do you see the internet as a means of distracting voters from issues that are actually important?
I don't actually see the internet as distracting voters from issues. I think it's given a new, depending on what sites you're going to, I think it's given a new outlet to a lot of the issues. I mean, I think this has been a pretty substantive campaign. No campaign is as substantive as we idealists would like, but I think this has been a pretty good campaign. If you compare it to some in the past, it's markedly better. And I think the internet's played some role in that. I mean, there are all kinds of websites talking about every kind of issue. And, you know, people feel that they can be invested in it. They can take part in that discussion. They can weigh in. I mean, there's, you know, yeah, 90%, 95% of what's discussed online is about tactics. How you win and how you frame and what language and whose door to knock on and all the things that none of these people actually know anything about. But nor do I, for the most part. But at the end of the day, you know, there's still some substance that goes on there, and certainly a lot of the journalism has been substantive. So, you know, I think by and large it's been a pretty substantive campaign. Yeah. What year are you?
I'm a sophomore.
Is this the first presidential election you've been old enough to vote in?
Yeah.
It is, right? You have voting absentee? Where did you say you were from?
Chicago.
No.
Yeah.
Well, hey, I live in Washington, D.C. We're in the same boat. You know, I can vote for anybody I want. You know, this is one area of the debates where I think we've very much fallen into this thing I was talking about before with you about, you know, the 15-minute news cycle. It's bad enough we treat the debates like a game. Who won, who lost, who got in a good jab, who got in a good counterpunch. Like, I call it the ESPNing of politics, which is what we've basically done. I love it on ESPN. I just don't want it in my politics. But now we've got these poor reporters, my poor colleagues, who are like Insta-blogging. That was a good line. Did you see that? Did you see that facial expression? I was like, oh my God, this is like craziness, right? This is not how debates get won. This is not the point of a debate, right? You can't measure debates that way. The point of debates is it's like going on TV to be interviewed in a sense. You come with a message. There's something you need to get across in a debate if you're a good debater. And the only thing you can be measured by is whether you got your point across and dismantled whatever the other guy's point was that he wanted to get across. It's possible for both people to win a debate. It's possible, and very often, no one wins a debate, right? So I find them very interesting. I find them exciting. I never find them boring because, you know, I'm looking at it from that much more pulled back viewpoint, which is like who's getting across what they need to get across, right? It's not about who has the most memorable zinger. People are pretty much immune to that anyway. You know, I mean, you're too young to remember the great, you know, Lloyd Benson's great lines. You're no Jack Kennedy, Dan Quayle. And, you know, there have been some great, you know, debate lines, some great moments. George Bush looking at his watch. Ronald Reagan in the primaries and this tremendous, you know, I paid for this microphone, Mr. Green. No one remembers what that was about, but it was a terrific moment. Got the name of the guy wrong. That pretty much premised everything that was to come later. But, you know, that's not the way to look. That's not really what debates are about. Now, for instance, I thought John McCain actually had a great debate, the first debate. Now, I was apparently wrong because all the dial groups said the voters didn't like it. But actually, he came there with a message. He came there and said, I'm going to show people that Barack Obama does not get foreign policy. He hasn't been doing this long enough. I get it. And he hammered that again and again and again. Now, it turned off some people. But you know what? People always tell you they don't like negative ads, but it doesn't mean they don't take the message away with them. So in my view, McCain had a pretty good debate because he may have turned off some. Some of the voters may have found it a little distasteful that he was on the attack. That didn't mean they didn't believe every word he said because he'd said it 25 times. It didn't mean they didn't question Obama's readiness at the end of the day. So, you know, I look at debates from a much more global perspective, and I find them, you know, great fun. I really do. And, you know, it's funny. I remember I was in college when Michael Dukakis was running against George H.W. Bush, and I remember being a junior here at Tufts and watching that debate with a whole group of people. And I remember everybody screaming and yelling and getting into it. I know what you're talking about. And I was at Cal State Monterey during this last debate last week or the week before, and I watched it with students there. It was a huge auditorium. And And there was the same thing. Even the faculty, which I thought was a little distasteful, were kind of getting into it. You know, whoop, whoop, yeah. You know, it was like screaming at the screen and stuff. I don't think faculty should do that, but I might be in the wrong place. But beyond that, I mean, that's cool. But then I think you get older, and like, I don't know, where I am now, not just because I'm covering it, just who I am, I watch, and I kind of just want to watch, like, by myself quietly and sort of, like, actually kind of, you know, listen to what they're saying and make sense of what's going on. But I think either way, it's a pretty cool experience. I love the debates. You know, I think you're right to find them exciting because I think they are. Yes? Vancouver, Canada.
Yes.
I really like that town a lot.
My question is about race.
Yeah.
There's this notion that Obama has been able to transcend race. And many would say that it's really just him being able to sweep the issue under the rug. Because clearly, as he said, it's been an issue. However, it hasn't been very much discussed throughout the campaign. So the transcending of race is kind of a euphemism for that sweeping under the rug.
Right, right. Yeah. That's a good question, Cody. I mean, I don't know what journalism will do. I mean, we're never good at things the first time. You know, they call journalism the rough draft of history. And I think if you went back and checked the coverage of any pivotal moment, in fact, there's probably an equation here. The more pivotal the moment in American history, if you went back and checked the journalism of the moment, you'd be a little bit ashamed because it takes a while for us to catch up. I mean, it's a totally different thing, but my most pressing example, my son is half Japanese-American, and my wife's family is all Japanese-American, and my father-in-law fought for the 442nd Regiment, and all of the other relatives in the family were interned in concentration camps for 5 years, and the American media said not a word. And when people tell me about how awful the media has been on Iraq and how miserable, you know, how we've never had such a horrible media, I always remind them, well, that's not true at all. We're actually much better than we used to be. There was this awful, awful moment for the American media. But the fact is that, you know, we always, you know, we do the best we can at the time, and then I think we evolve as a media. So, and I do think we get better. That's the good news. I don't think this discussion about race has been terribly enlightened. I wrote a cover on it that I'm very proud of, actually, and I do think it was good, but I may look back in 10 years and think it wasn't, which is called, Is Obama the End of Black Politics? My contention would be I don't like this idea of transcending race and, you know, he's race neutral, all these terms. I think that is going to reflect poorly in history. I think that's a dumb way to look at it, actually. It actually misses the significance of Obama. Because if Obama wins, the significance of Obama is that he is black and people get that he's black and that's okay. They get that he's actually culturally black. They get that he plays basketball, right? This is what Cory Booker said to me. It's like, it's okay for Barack Obama now to go play basketball, even though he's a black guy. That's okay. Because his experience is enough like the ordinary American experience that people can connect with him anyway. It's just like the immigrant experience, right? It's okay for Mario Cuomo to talk about his Italianism. It was okay for John Kennedy to talk about being Irish or Catholic because, you know, you reach a point in a society where those experiences are somewhat universal, where someone who hasn't shared that experience can still relate. And I think that's what we're seeing with Obama, that's the phenomenon we're seeing with Obama. Not that people don't notice that he's black, but that it's he can be black and that's okay. As long as he isn't angry, right? As long as he isn't hateful or resentful, as long as he doesn't have racial hang-ups, right? That's okay. And I think that's a great moment for African Americans, and I think it's a great moment for American politics. It has nothing to do with putting race away. It has to do with making race a surmountable barrier to our understanding one another and ultimately voting for one another. I think it's very important. I do think the amazing thing about the thing that makes Obama uniquely qualified to do this. He's not the most experienced black leader of his generation. He's not the, you know, he may not be in some ways the most impressive orator, black orator of his generation, certainly not the greatest policy mind among African Americans of his generation. But he is, and I guess it's by virtue perhaps of the mixed race lineage, and it's obviously something in him that has nothing to do with race, but he has total equanimity. He has no resentment. I mean, it's not just what he displays. I actually think it isn't there. I've had people who know him well and people who actually don't like it. They're not being complimentary, who've said to me, you know, this guy just has no you know, Donna Brazile said to me at one point, she was on the record, she said, you know, he has no race bone. She said, you know, I have a race bone. I can take it out and pick it when I'm angry. This guy has no race bone. He exhibits, even to the people closest to him, no animosity, no resentment, no victimization. He seems to have, he doesn't feel aggrieved. He would probably have a right to. I'm sure he's experienced racism in his life. He couldn't not have. He went to Harvard. He's a black guy in law school. I mean, he certainly knows what it's like to be treated differently in different ways. But he doesn't, he has not internalized it in any kind of hostile way. And that makes him uniquely suited to be the guy to kind of cross that barrier. Because I think that's the piece of it that we can't get past as a country, is always white people feeling that black people hate them, black people feeling that white people look down on them and resent them, right? It's the fact that you never know what the person is saying when they're just with their friends, right? When they're only with their own race, you know, what are they saying about you? It's that mutual sort of paranoia and resentment, and not paranoia because a lot of it's real, but it's that sort of mutual suspicion that makes race so hard to overcome. And I think it's what is singular about Obama is that he gives people no sense that in the privacy of his own home with his own friends or his own family that he's saying anything different about white America or feeling anything more hostile than he displays as a candidate. And I think that's why people are ultimately finding their heads, getting their heads around being able to vote for him. Yes?
Hi, my name is Jess Wicket. I'm also Kelsey Beckett.
Quite the contingent.
We brought them, we imported them, Matt.
And I have a question.
I saw all the nice cars on campus, so I know there's a fair Fairfield County contingent. I'm from Fairfield County as well. Get it out, Jess. Get it out.
So the United States of November 2008 is not exactly the United States of when Barack Obama announced his candidacy for presidency. I think a lot has changed since then, most notably the economy. And having had long conversations with him, having spent time with him, having spent a lot of time watching him and writing about him, particularly in regard to the experience. What are your thoughts on his level of preparation or his ability to judge him for possibly taking the reins of a country that maybe isn't exactly the country that he thought he was getting into running when he first started this so long ago?
Well, I can't, first of all, claim to have spent a lot of time with him. I mean, I've interviewed him a couple of times, and I've talked to him recently, but I'm not, I by no means know him well. There are politicians I know well, and he's not one of them. And the short answer really is I don't know. I mean, I don't know, you know, how much, I mean, I don't know what his grasp of that, I don't think anybody knows what his grasp of that is really going to be. You know, someone who talks with him pretty frequently told me recently that Obama told him in a quiet moment, he said, I don't worry about losing. He said, when I stay up at night, I'm not worried about losing. I stay up at night worrying about winning. And if that's true, and I think it is, I don't think it was spin, I think that's a pretty healthy attitude. Like, the one thing I will say about Obama is in my experience around him and talking, mostly from talking to people who know him well, is that he has a real self-awareness and a sense of humility and a sense of wanting to learn and get his head around things. You know, he's not, he knows that he doesn't know things. And he knows that there are, you know, pitfalls to arrogance. I think he really wants to get it right, and I kind of think that's half the battle. He's not looking to prove a point. He's not looking to further an agenda. He kind of wants to get it right. I mean, America has traditionally done best with people, with leaders who are mostly pragmatic before they're ideological, right? Because that's where the public's basically pragmatic. And I think we've done best under leaders who, you know, want to get from point A to point B and are not so much concerned about how, right, are willing to sort of do what they need to do to solve problems and crises. And I think Obama definitely falls in that tradition. I think McCain does too. I think he's run a very unfortunate campaign. And I think history will be kinder to McCain than his campaign and harsher on his campaign than it needed to be. But I do think, you know, he's run a, you know, I do think he's tried to run a campaign that cast him as a candidate that he isn't really. And I think he is a pragmatist. And I thought, you know, I frankly think it was a pretty good choice between both of these guys. And I still think that at the end of the day, even though I was disappointed in McCain's campaign and surprised and a little dismayed at his vice presidential pick, as I think, you know, a lot of Republicans are. I don't know if y'all, this goes back to the question about debates, but any of you watch The West Wing? Are you West Wing fans? It's out of syndication now. I can't find it. It's one of my favorites. My favorite way to pass late night hours when I can't sleep. And there's a wonderful, one of my favorite West Wing episodes is in the debate when Martin Sheen is running against James Brolin. And they debate, and Martin Sheen just kicks his ass. You know, and he's on top of his game and just and Brolin is like the bushy character. He's sort of like, he's this swaggering southern governor. And I think he's the governor of Florida, right? And he doesn't really know anything. And he's all like, he's like vague, you know, aphorisms. And it's, you know, it all turns into a mess. And at the end, everybody cheers. It's very loud. And the two of them meet center stage and they shake hands. Do you remember this? They shake hands and James Brolin leans over to Martin Sheen and he says, "It's over." And Martin Sheen says, "You'll be back." Right? That's the one they go. I thought of that recently. I was watching this last debate. I couldn't help thinking of that. I thought, I think McCain probably knows it's over. I don't think he'll be back. But I think he probably will have some time to reflect. And the history of McCain as a public servant is a guy who sins and then atones. This is his narrative as a public servant. He's always writing books or going out and trying to reverse the things he thinks he's done wrong. It's like a show of character. So I strongly suspect that within the next 5 years, he'll endeavor to write some book in which he talks about what a crappy campaign, you know, what a sort of ignoble campaign he ran. But I could be wrong. Yeah.
You talked a lot about.
Who are you?
Oh, I'm Robin. Sorry, I'm from Oregon.
We have to get that. We have to know because you could be an imposter and you have to be sent home. Yes. Oregon. What part of Oregon?
Eugene. Anyways.
That's good, Democratic country.
Yeah. You talked a lot about how white men view Obama, and the selection cycle also had a lot of gender politics in it, and I just wanted to know how you see the future of gender politics. How you think? Like, do you think a woman has as good of a chance to become president as a black man?
Yeah. I get asked this a lot, and I answer it wrongly, I think. Nobody's ever happy with my answer. It's possible I've not thought this through enough, or it's possible I'm just a guy. So I don't proclaim to have the definitive answer here, but I think we're past it. I really do. I think there was very little gender politics. And it's like, look, Hillary Clinton, you know, yes, they sold the Hillary Clinton nutcracker at the airport, and I thought that was pretty disgusting. But, you know, she ran for over a year as the establishment candidate of the Democratic Party. They called donors and said, "Max out to my primary and general election. And if you give mine to anybody else, you're out." And they ran as the absolute establishment enforcer candidate. And, you know, nobody blinked. It wasn't like anybody said, "She can't do that. She's a woman." And then when things went bad, they turned around and said, well, you know, a lot of them turned around and said, "Well, you know, it was sexism. The media was sexist." Well, you can't really do both. I mean, she ran as a candidate completely apart from gender. It just didn't figure into the equation. And, you know, they set themselves up as a certain kind of candidacy. And I don't think, you know, in fact, the only thing that saved her candidacy from ruin in New Hampshire was the fact that she cried. So if you're going to live by it, you can't really then, you know, if you're going to, no guy could have gotten away with that, right? So if you're going to benefit from sexual standards, you can't, you know, gender standards, you can't then turn around and say, you know, there's a double standard. So, you know, I right, Ed Muskie, right? Is that what somebody's saying? I know you guys are thinking, I didn't even hear you, but I knew you were talking about Ed Muskie. It's generational, never mind. I actually think gender was not her problem. I think nobody had difficulty seeing Sarah Palin. I mean, Sarah Palin's problem is not gender. She's meeting no double standard. If anything, she's getting more support from women than she deserves because she's a woman. So, you know, I think we've pretty much crossed that barrier. I just think it's taken, you know, politics lags the culture. It always does. I don't know why, it just does. We have fewer women senators than we should. We have fewer women governors than we should. But, you know, just as with African Americans, with or without Obama, I think that's going to change in the next 10 years. And, you know, I think a woman, you know, there are qualified women candidates now. I think you will probably see a woman run in most, if not every cycle from here on out. And I think they'll be very viable candidates. So, I mean, there are pockets of sexism, there are pockets of bigotry of all kinds, and every candidate has to surmount something. But I don't think I don't think sexism played a major role in this campaign, and I think the electorate is, you know, pretty ready to elect a woman if there's a candidate who warrants it. I could be wrong. Disagree with me?
No, I think it does a little bit more for men. And in terms of even comments that people made that they wouldn't vote for her because of her husband, like, I don't think most people say I wouldn't vote for him because of his wife.
Well, yeah, but no male candidate has a wife who was president.
Yeah, but they could have different impacts, certainly. And I think
that might be true.
I think people get judged independently more as men.
That might be true, but there again, there's no way Hillary Clinton is sitting in that position if she were not married to Bill Clinton.
Right.
So this all cuts, you know, it all cuts both ways. You know, I think when they decided to run as the inevitable establishment steamroller, they pretty much gave up all claim to, you know, being victimized.
Well, she ran a poor campaign.
And they ran a poor campaign, and she wasn't, you know, I think they were not cognizant of the landscape in the Democratic Party as clearly as they should have been had they read my book. Anyone else? Have I exhausted you all? Oh, there's one more. Go ahead. Everybody else is like, oh, my God, what is her problem? Get out of here. Yeah. What's your name?
Gabby.
Gabby, New York City. What part of New York City?
Manhattan.
What part of Manhattan? I knew you were from Manhattan. What part of Manhattan?
Upper East Side.
Perfect. Okay. You're a reader. You're definitely a reader then, right? Okay.
Too much epic homework.
Yeah. I guess I'm wondering whether you fear that there will be any great attempts to tamper with votes or fraudulent polling practices or anything in the upcoming election. Whether that will kind of
last few elections. I got to be honest with you, Gabby. I'm going to be honest with you. This is a total blind spot for me. I get these calls at least once a week. Somebody calls or emails me, you got to write about this voting fraud. My eyes just glaze over. Like, and I'll tell you why. Let's preface this. It's not that I don't care. I think any voter suppression or irregularities are important. I'm glad there are organizations out there working to fix it. And I think they have to do that. If they weren't doing that, I'd be the first. If there weren't organizations out there, I'd be the first one jumping on it. But I think there's been, you know, and again, for you, this is probably, how old are you?
19.
Right, so this is your entire political consciousness begins with 2000. There's been a fixation over the last 8 years because we've had two historically close elections on this tiny, tiny margin, exceedingly rare in American politics. We've got this fixation on the irregularities, when in fact the irregularities really occur in like every election. I look at democracy as like a scale. If you get on the scale and you want to know whether you weigh 1 pound more or 1 pound less, that scale is going to be very good for you. If you get on a pound and you want to know if you weigh 1/10 of a pound more or 1/10 of a pound less, you're never going to get what you want. It's going to tell you something different every time you step on it. It's just not calibrated within 1/10 of a pound. And American democracy is not calibrated for elections that fall within a percentage point. There's just a lot of people are going to the polls and putting paper in boxes and hitting machines, and some number of votes are always going to be like lost by some idiot at a polling place who like put the box in her purse and went home, whatever the hell it is. Like, something is always going to get screwed. I mean, it happened. But in elections like 1960 and like 2000, and to, you know, in elections where you have this very narrow margin, you know, people can always point to something. And again, with seriousness, it's not, you know, these are serious problems. But if you really want to get past voting fraud, you got really two choices as I see it. You can devote all your time to worrying about what's happening in ballot boxes and trying to make sure that not a single box disappears into somebody's purse by accident, and you know, in some small town. Or you can go out and win an election by 1.5 points. Because if you go out and win an election by 1.5 points, nobody's taking it away from you. They can try as hard as they want. So in my view, it's a little bit of a red herring. I'm sure there will be irregularities. I'm glad there are people trying to stamp them out and make sure it doesn't happen. I'm glad there's lawyers at polling places. But I don't think anybody's going to be able to steal this election from Barack Obama, in my view. Something could change between now and 8 days from now. But if he goes out and wins an election by 5 points and, you know, 50-odd electoral votes, you know, that some vote's going to get stolen from somebody, but it's not going to change the result. And I think that's the big picture.
Going once, twice. Thank you, Matt.